Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dream Freedom Beauty Podcast. I am your hostess, Natalie Ross, and today's guest is back on the show for the third time, Miss Carolyn Elliott, who I just adore, and it's obvious because I've had her on the show so many times. But for real, this woman, if I could teach what she teaches better, I would, but I can't. So I just want to promote her and all that she does because it's a true service to anyone who wants to integrate their conscious and unconscious sides and bring that shadow and that light together and embody and approve of and accept the whole spectrum of who they are. And that's why I love what Carolyn does and why I want to promote it. Because that's something I have found in my own path to be super healing. And when I came across the work she does, I was just like, dang, she takes all this different stuff I've done, weaves it all together, adds a few different elements of spice and pepper, and like makes it so easeful and powerful and transformative. And you don't have to be experienced to learn from her and to learn through her methods. You just have to be willing to take a deep, honest look at yourself, and she'll guide you the rest of the way with her lessons and exercises and approaches to doing this extremely powerful, transformative work. So she's not paying me to say this. This is just me saying this because I see in so many people who reach out to me that what Carolyn offers is exactly the type of medicine that I think would serve them, would serve you. And I feel like it's my duty to express this as clearly as possible to you and really share that, because that's why we're all gathered here, is to get this kind of insight and medicine. And before we get into today's show, I want to send a huge thank you to all of the Patreon supporters. Thank you, Mindy Stock. Thank you, Rehart. Thank you, Ashley Mello, our newest Patreon supporters, for supporting the production of this show. And if you're interested in helping to support this show, you can check out Patreon and search for Dream Freedom Beauty and hook it up. Help us produce the show and keep it coming. And I also want to send a huge thank you to everyone who has written iTunes reviews or reviews anywhere, really. And I'm going to read this latest one from Junebug0620. Thank you, Junebug. I love this podcast so much and every guest that is on it. So much wonderful information involving all things magic and nature. Thank you so much, ladies. Well, thank you, Junebug, for sharing your love and for sharing a little bit in your review that might help some other people see that this podcast is a yes or a no for them. And I do want to mention that we strive to have the best sound quality we can have here, and sometimes there's technical difficulties, so we've done the best we can with the sound on this episode. And if you're a new listener, I just want you to know that not all episodes are crackly like this one, maybe in some points, so just bear with us here. Thank you. And without further ado, let's do this show. Welcome to the show, Carolyn. It's awesome to have you back, and I'm so excited to get into stuff today.
Yes, thank you for having me, Natalie.
Totally. And for listeners, they can get two amazing doses of you if they need more, and I'll repeat these at the end of the episode. But for listeners, Carolyn is a repeat guest because I love everything she does, and I think that everyone needs to check out what she does because they can benefit greatly from it. But we've had Carolyn on episode 54 and episode 67, and I will tell you that again at the end, but just to put a little seed in all of y'all's minds. So Carolyn, would you like to lead us on an invocation to get into this space of this conversation?
I definitely would. So I just want to invite everyone listening to take a moment, take a deep breath, close your eyes. And I really want you to just allow yourself to remember a time when you just felt like a shock of surprise and revelation. Something was shown to you, something happened, something opened up, and it could be really tiny, like just a moment of deja vu, or it could have been really major. But whatever it is, just that sensation of wonder, we could call that intimacy with reality. And to me, that's really what magic is. It's intimacy with reality, with the kind of raw, pulsing, strange stuff of life. And I want to invite you to just kind of let that awareness stay present in your body as you listen to our podcast today.
Thank you. Cool. So something that I think is really interesting about you is that you have a doctorate in critical and cultural studies, a master's degree in English, and a bachelor's of arts in creative writing. And you say that none of this stuff matters.
It doesn't. It gave me, I mean, and when I say that, I mean, it's slightly tongue in cheek. Like, obviously that all of that stuff gave me time to read a lot, which was wonderful. And I definitely learned a few things along the way, but yeah, it really doesn't matter.
And so can you reveal to us and enlighten us with what does matter? And this means it doesn't matter in the context of actually having a business and being able to connect with people and sell them your services, you know, like to do your dharma essentially and give people what it is that you gift to them through your services and offerings, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's, I have friends, like women who are best friends of mine, who will say things to me like, oh, Carolyn, I would love to do what you do, but you know, I didn't get my PhD. And I was always like, that has nothing to do with this. I mean, it's really just about communication and communicating what we have found to be true and to be worthwhile and to be pragmatically effective and offering that to other people. So it's definitely true. Like in school, you can pick up communication skills and have a chance to practice them, but it's often a kind of communication that you actually have to unlearn in order to be able to do this kind of communication, like communicating with a large audience. When I wrote my dissertation, I had a dissertation committee with four people on it. And the thing that I wrote, this whole book that I wrote, the dissertation, was essentially for those four people who were specialists in the field. So these days, when I'm trying to communicate with thousands, you know, hopefully one day millions of people, the style of communication is a lot different. But what you need, and what a lot of people I think struggle to find, and maybe they hope that the credentials of school will give them, is a sense of inner validation, like a sense of inner self-trust. And that was certainly why I was going to get my PhD. I really hoped that I would get this credential and it would validate me and I would feel, you know, up to snuff. I think what actually happened is that in a way it did work like that, in the sense that I spent all this time reading all these dead white men and their stuff. And eventually, after I'd read thousands of pages of it, it finally clicked. Oh, nobody knows what they're talking about.
Awesome.
Literally nobody knows. And if you can just, you know, my theory is as good as anybody else's, was basically what came through. And I guess that's sort of what the special virtue of an education in critical and cultural studies will give you, because critical and cultural studies is sort of all about looking at how things are positioned rhetorically and how basically how all arguments are relative. And even something like science, which, you know, you trained as a scientist, Natalie, so I'm sure you've thought about this a lot.
Oh, I feel like you're speaking my exact thoughts.
Yeah, which is that science purports to be objective, which means that it purports to be a kind of absolute truth. But it's really what we have, what operates in our culture is scientism, which is actually a kind of religion. which has this idea of only the material world exists, only what measures exists. If it can't be measured, if it can't be quantified, then it's pure hogwash and we shan't bother sullying ourselves with it. So, which is actually a really dogmatic belief system.
Totally. And, you know, that's, as you said, I have a background in science and I learned so many similar things from studying science. I love science, by the way, but it still is its own religion, as you say. And one of the reasons I started this whole podcast was because of that kind of invalidating feeling I had that, like, oh my gosh, all this stuff that I'm experiencing and feeling is totally dismissed by the entirety of science. So what am I supposed to do? And I was kind of like, you know what? Similar to you, I was like, I'm just going to make it up and go with, you know, go explore it.
Go explore it. Yeah. One of my favorite dead old white men is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I need to look up the quote. It's in his essay somewhere where he talks about if you really want to find truth that will be relevant to other people, you need to look at what is most fundamentally true for you. And whatever is really at a deep level true for you, when you share it with other people, many of them will find that it's really true and really helpful for them also. So when I took in that wisdom from Emerson, that really helped me make the leap to communicating with a larger audience. And Emerson, of course, was one of the first popular self-help writers. So, Yeah, Ralph Waldo.
I never thought of him. That's cool. I like that idea of him as a self-help writer. That's hilarious.
Oh, he was a total self-help writer. He, after he got kicked out of the Unitarian Church, he made his living by going around giving inspirational talks.
Dang. So that's where he was like Tony Robbins' mentor.
Pretty much. He was like, yeah, the original Tony Robbins Oprah.
Oh my God. So something that, you know, that's important with all of this, kind of wrapped up in all of this, is the idea of being intimate. And I think, you know, like the idea, there's this idea that if you go to school and do all the things and get all the degrees that you'll be successful. But something I love about what you do and what you speak of is that actually it's intimacy that helps create success. And most of us are spending our time avoiding intimacy and we don't even know like how to be intimate with ourselves. So can you share with me and my listeners some more of that insight and perspective that you carry?
Ooh, I love that you've honed in on that, Natalie. Yeah. So basically, where to begin? Intimacy, a reason why we avoid it is because it's highly sensational. It's whenever we let somebody feel us as we are in this moment, there's electricity there, you know, in a friend way or in a sexy way or whatever, in a me sharing with an audience way or somebody else sharing with an audience, there's an opening and an energy. And I always think of like in one of my favorite grimoires, the Bible, where Jesus says, when two or more are gathered in my name, you know, I will be there. And I think of that, there's like this charge, like this divine charge when two of us, seemingly individual consciousnesses, get together in some way and have a shared experience. So it's really understandable that we would want to avoid that because our culture does very little to prepare us to be present in that kind of emotional, physical sensation. Most people very easily go completely unconscious when confronted with a lot of sensation. It's why we like to avoid conflict or make everything into a conflict. Or, you know, it's like very difficult. So there's that. And there's also the interesting thing that intimacy can only happen between two subjects. So I'm a subject, you're a subject, that means that a potential for intimacy can exist. But our culture, especially with the religion of scientism, emphasizes relationships that are subject-object. So here I am, I'm a subject, and I'm studying this thing, and it is the object of my study. And I have this kind of power over it, or like I'm somehow more than it. And this kind of objectification of the world, also we could call it like the desacralization of the world, is really what has happened. And so it's, we have also that as a handicap that I would say it's pretty obvious that Indigenous cultures cultivate a relational attitude towards other people, towards the land, the elements, the spirits, everything. They're constantly referring to things relationally, like Grandmother Moon, for example. Whereas, you know, we want to just say that the moon is a hunk of dirt and there it is, we can observe it and take some notes about it, but it doesn't mean anything and it certainly isn't a person that we could relate to. Mm-hmm. I think that stepping into a more magical worldview is very healing because it gives us an opportunity to go back into that much more relational state of being where we are realizing that us human beings, or even, you know, some of us like me at times are very solipsistic and tend to think that we're the only ones in the world.
What
other people exist and have feelings. So stepping outside of that solipsism and realizing that there are these other intelligences, other emotional beings that are present to be met
as subjects.
As subjects that need to be dealt with on their own terms, you know, with respect and kindness and all that good stuff. That's pretty daring. And it's also pretty daring to just be willing to not treat the world as an object, essentially. And I feel like it sounds a little abstract when I'm talking about it in this way. Maybe I should slow down a bit.
I feel like I'm getting it. I mean, I get it. And I would like to ask something in relation to it, unless you would really like to state it another way.
Oh, you want me to state it another way?
No, if you would like to.
Oh, no. No, I'm cool.
Okay. So I'm thinking, okay, we have this intimacy is from this subject-subject connection. Like, I am a living conscious being. You are a living conscious being. We're interacting with each other. And we can create intimacy within this interaction. Mm-hmm. But in the subject-object view, it's like, I am a living being. And that over there is a tree. And that tree is an object. And I have power over that tree. I can control the tree. I can learn about the tree. But it's not a being,
right?
That, and what it wants, the value of a subject.
Yeah, and maybe the essential thing that makes it an object is that its desires don't matter.
Uh huh. Right. It doesn't even have desires in that mm-hmm. context of it being an object. And so I can see how it could be also, you know, that we could go on a lot of different directions with this, but just something that shows up is okay if you're living in, it's which most of society is living in, this subject-object paradigm, the subject, the human, has this sort of power over and right to control and manipulate and exploit things, versus when you move to a subject-subject paradigm, it's less of that power over, and I can see how there'd be a lot of fear of losing that sense of power. Does that make any sense?
Yes, that totally makes sense. And I think that's exactly what happens. Of course, the kicker is that the sense of power that we get from being in that subject-object relationship is certainly substantial in some ways. Like, you can have the power to cut down a whole forest, you know, things like that, and use those resources however, let's say. But in the long term, it's always kind of an empty win. Like, it's not really fulfilling to do that.
Because there's no intimacy.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. So we as a culture are in this position where, you know, there's this opioid epidemic where hundreds of thousands of people are addicted and dying. And that kind of, and not even, there's all the obesity stuff and all the other depression stuff. Just we're beset by these very, very painful disorders. And I really think that at the root of that is this alienation that comes from living in the subject-object framework that doesn't, where we are very lonely, essentially, and we don't feel the fulfillment that comes with connection and intimacy with our world.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's so foreign to people to even, they're like, how do I create intimacy? I mean, people pay so much money to specialists to, you know, learn how to create intimacy, and, you know, or they'd rather just run away from all that because opening up to the pleasure is opening to the pain. So why bother? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's interesting. I mean, I've paid so much money to specialists to learn how to open up to intimacy, and I still have so much to learn. It's like, it shouldn't be a rarefied thing like that, but that's the state of affairs right now. And yeah, this thing of like the pleasure comes with pain, that is also definitely true. Like talking about being present in high sensation, some of that high sensation is very pleasurable, you know, like the joy of like really sharing a hilarious joke with somebody. And of course, some of it is really painful, like the pain of feeling somebody be really angry at you. And, you know, receiving that energy is very intense. And it is true that you can't have one without the other. So it's, you know, people talk about being vulnerable, and I guess that term is maybe a little bit overused, but I think it really means just like being willing to show up for the whole range of sensation that happens in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to mirror, because something that I've just come to realize through doing this show is that, you know, I want to mirror that I too have paid lots of money to learn how to be intimate, and not just paid lots of money, but given lots of time and sought a lot of support and experts and mentors and teachers and guides and counseling and all of that, because that's the, as you said, like that's the state of affairs that our society is in, is that we have to like really go seek it if we want it. So I just want to, I've just realized that one of the biggest gifts I think I can give listeners is to encourage them to also value themselves enough to invest in whatever it takes for them to achieve some sort of true intimacy with themselves and others.
Mm. Definitely. Definitely. And probably intimacy with oneself is the hardest.
Why?
Because it takes honesty. I mean, all intimacy takes honesty, but there's levels of it. And, you know, sometimes I find that there's things that I have been hiding from myself, so to speak. Like, I always find like new layers of like, wow, for months I've really been justifying being really mean, you know, in these situations, and I have this whole justification about it. And I have to be honest with myself and like be willing to see like where, you know, why that was happening and to stop doing it. And like all of these things coming, how do I say it more concretely? I think there's very little education given to us in our culture also about being aware of our own motivations. So, our unconscious motivations. So like, when am I doing something just because I want some approval and a pat on the head? When am I doing something because I just want to look cool to my friends? When am I not doing something because I'm afraid of it, versus when am I not doing something because it's really something that I have chosen is actually not for me, you know, like all these fine distinctions.
So subtle.
Mm-hmm. It's so subtle. It really is. And it takes attention and time to sort it out. You know, journaling helps me a lot. And also just like my friends confront me about stuff all the time because they're like that. but it's, especially the fear thing is very easy for me to want to stay in a comfort zone and not push that edge of like learning or exposing myself to making mistakes or failing or all of that stuff. And so it's continual effort to keep pushing forward.
Right. You know, I would, and something just from my own experience would be like, it's hard to be, for me, it's hard for me to be honest with myself because you have to be able to kind of look at yourself in a mirror. And that's, I mean, I feel like that's where meditation and journaling really help, is they help you step outside of the experience and look, have that kind of outside in look at what's happening in there.
Yeah, totally. And it just, as we were talking, it occurred to me that one reason I think why intimacy with oneself can be so hard is because people don't, if we think about like dating or friendship or whatever, like think about the last time that you opened up to a new friend. It was probably because that person seemed like they were kind and they had a sense of humor and they liked you. And sometimes the way, oftentimes the way that we relate to ourselves or the way that I relate to myself is not all that kind. And I notice as I become kinder to myself, I will let myself see these deeper layers of where I've been hiding out of fear or anything like that. Like greater intimacy with myself comes the less judgmental I'm willing to be with myself.
And so of course I want to ask you, can you share with us something you've recently had to come to terms with about yourself?
Oh yeah, sure. Let's see. Oh, where to begin? Okay. So this goes into, well, first of all, I think I should start the story by saying, by talking about where some recent inspiration came for me.
Okay.
Because I was out in the wilderness of Indiana supporting one of my best friends as she did her Lakota style vision quest. So she was with, we were with a Lakota medicine woman, and she was out in the wilderness. And the idea of a vision quest is you go out for 4 days, 4 nights without any food or water, and you just sit in a certain little designated area and you pray. So she had done this 3 times before, and she was supposed to do it 4 times to complete her commitment and then go on to start sun dancing. And this time she was out there for 3 days and she ended up coming back to camp early. So she broke her commitment. And she is somebody who is so serious and so dedicated and so deep with her spiritual work. I was really afraid for her that she was going to be super hard on herself about it. Because number one, I mean, it's understandable. Like she was having real issues with not having water for those days. And it's probably a great thing that she came back because you can die from not having water. And I was just worried that she was going to be judging herself too harshly because I was thinking, geez, if I was in her situation and I had, you know, I was in the last legs of this massive commitment that I had made and I decided to come in early, I would probably feel like so like guilty and ashamed and miserable. And she gave me the most beautiful gift possible. Like when I talked to her about it after she had been through the sweat lodge and had the purification and everything, I could see that she was a little bit bothered, and she was bothered for maybe like an hour or so. But as we talked about it, you know, she turned and she looked at me and she said, you know what? I got so excited because I realized, she was like, I didn't want to let myself know that I failed. But then she was like, hey, I failed. I completely failed. This is amazing. And she really got it, got this sense of like, that failure was part of the range of things that is okay. and that happens. And she didn't have to tell herself that she hadn't failed. She could accept failure and yet like not be hard on herself about it. Be really see it as something beautiful and something that connects her to other people, because you know, we as humans are constantly failing at things. That's like what we do mostly. So I was just so inspired. She just transmitted this understanding of self-forgiveness. And I saw, you know, really clearly just how I deprive myself of that level of self-forgiveness. So working with that and using her as an inspiration, I just began to take a closer look at some patterns in my own life. And something that I judge myself very harshly for are the arguments that I have had maybe on like a weekly basis with my partner. And when I say arguments, like they're fights, but they're not even about anything. They're like, they're basically just like shame, guilt, reactivity roundabouts. And I adore my husband and I work with him and he's just like the light of my life. And it was really driving me crazy that every so often we will trigger each other into these little spirals that are like very draining and just yucky and not fun. And I had been like so hard on myself, like why, you know, I teach these classes, I do these things, why can't I get my shit together and not repeat this boring, sucky pattern? And it was like after I really learned, I saw my friend forgive herself in this way, I really realized that I love believing that things are bad. So I love believing that it is really bad and really terrible that I have these reactive fights with my partner. And part of what makes those reactive fights happen in the first place is that I love to believe that something about me is lacking and something about him is lacking and bad, wrong, terrible, dangerous. And that it's just all together. And it's like, since I've had that realization, there've been a few moments when I've been tempted to go into the reactivity. And instead I've been able to be like, oh, I'm doing that thing that I really enjoy doing where I want to see this situation as horrible and terrible and dangerous and bad. That's so great. I love that I let myself do that. It's so entertaining. And the reactivity has sort of, you know, simmered down. So, you know, I have some hope. I'm on to something now. Because it's, you know, it's an interesting cycle, judging myself for the fight happening and the way that my judging myself makes the fight happen in the first place. Cause it, you know, it's just really, it's so interesting to me, the cycles. So that's my latest revelation, Natalie.
Thank you, Carolyn. So I'm curious to know, what is it do you love about feeling like you're bad or everything's terrible? Or like, do you know that?
Yeah, what is it exactly? Well, first of all, I love that there's the sense of scarcity with it. Like there's a complete scarcity of rightness and goodness and lovableness in the world. There's a total like dearth of it. And in order to get rightness or goodness or lovableness, Herculean tasks have to be undertaken. And there's sort of like this arc of like damnation and redemption that is created. And it is one of the values of it is that it can really focus my attention on getting a particular task done. and it can, you know, there's just a way in which for, I guess, up until this moment in my life, I haven't been completely comfortable with like bliss and wonder and love and joy all the time, nonstop. And the game, it's because that's sort of really what it is. It's like it's a scarcity game or a badness game that I play on myself, is really entertaining, just like watching a scary movie or a dramatic movie. Like, it just takes me on a trip. It's psychedelic too. That's what I realized after taking some psychedelics and reflecting on various experiences, which is that basically we are always tripping. Like, we are always, right. Yeah, we're just always tripping. And it's very, creating a bad trip is just as easy to do that not on LSD as as on LSD. Mm-hmm. And those spirals of reactivity are just kind of like bad trips. And they're ones that I've been habituated to and that my family was very, very habituated to. So that's another thing that I love about it, is that it helps me feel connected to my family. It's like carrying on my parents' viewpoints and serving them and validating them, like by proving how terrible things are and how terrible I am and everybody else is. It really confirms the hypotheses that I learned from Linda and Carmen Elliott.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And I love something that I think is evident from the story of your friend on her failure, is she was able to see that the experience of failure, like, can be just as ecstatic as the experience of success. Mm-hmm. And that's something, and I know that's something that you like to teach too, about, you know, how can we tap into that ecstasy of experience as experience without the judgment of it being good or bad? Like, what's, you know, the ecstasy of being embodied and alive and being able to experience something that's a failure. I mean, that's pretty magical and psychedelic, like you say.
Truly, truly it is. And that's probably the distinguishing feature of a good trip versus a bad trip is, you know, in a good trip, we're just not judging our experience.
Mm, right. We're just letting ourselves get blissed out. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I know, because I've had good trips and bad trips as well. Oh, wow. Yeah. So something kind of tied into all of this is, I love how you say that we all know how to wildly succeed, and that it's something that humans rigorously avoid because the act of consciously owning that kind of knowledge brings with it a painful disruption to our current identities as people who don't know and who aren't wildly successful. And I just read that straight from one of your articles. I think the like 7 principles that made you $18,000 in a month. Mm-hmm. That's what it's from. So you talk about how identity is the most precious thing to human beings. And so many people's identities are wrapped up in their experiences of things being bad, and they're so terrified to change. Can you speak more about that and about identities and how it's all tied into this?
Oh yeah, definitely. Whew. Well, first of all, it's like, it's so interesting to me how many layers of it there are. Like, I've done a good amount to like heal that layer with my money stuff, but obviously, you know, I still have some healing with my intimacy stuff to do. And there's still some level at which my identity is tied to this notion of like, I lack total love. I'm not being loved enough, or, you know, something like that. And it is so, how do I say? It's like, I accepted it into myself at one time, this truth or this notion. And it's almost just like, I don't want to reject it from myself. Like, it's
the
almost
notion of you being scared, lacking in some way. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, once having taken that in, it's like, it's so precious. Like, I just want to hold on to it forever. Like, it, and prove it true over and over again.
Right. You're like, oh, I found something to identify with. I'm not letting this go.
Well, and I think part of the reason why identity is so precious to us is because we all want to be limited. And if we didn't want to be limited, I don't think any of us would have incarnated in the first place, because that's essentially what incarnation is. It's a form of getting to experience yourself as limited to a body, to a location in space and time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly enlightened people have proven that you don't have to take that so seriously. Like, you can let go of that feeling of being limited to a body or a gender or, you know, space and time and everything. But I think there's a very deep tendency, I guess it's a karmic tendency that we humans have to want to be limited to a body, to a gender, to a space and time. And it's scary. There's this like vast, spacious unknown when we open up to the notion that like, maybe nothing limits me. Maybe there is literally nothing that limits me and nothing that defines me. So, and if that's true, then I'm not separate from everything that I'm experiencing. And that
everything that I hate.
And everything that I hate. Yes. Oh, you got it, Natalie. You went right for it. You're sharp. Yeah, precisely. I'm not separate from the neo-Nazis, and I'm not separate from all of the terrifying things going on in the world, or from cancer cells, and, you know, anything. There's like nothing that I'm separate from. And that's really, you know, that notion is pretty much the same as the Buddhist idea of no self, like that's, or emptiness, you know, like everything is empty of inherent selfhood. So that's, that can be a very difficult idea for our Western minds to begin wrapping around. And one way that I think that I've gotten more familiar with the idea is just by looking, really paying close attention to the ways that I unconsciously try to limit myself, that I'm, that on some level I'm actively always really trying hard to limit myself, because that's what an identity is. You can't have an identity without limitation. So in a way, the more you let go of your limitations, the more you let go of having an identity. And obviously that's scary.
Right. Who are you supposed to be then?
Exactly. And I'm not sure I have a neat answer for that, other than that it seems, or I hear reports from folks who are more enlightened than me, that even after you surrender holding yourself to a limited identity, there's still a body and there's still a personality that talks and walks and goes to the grocery store and does things. It's just, you're not so uptight about it anymore.
Actually, that segues perfectly into something else I wanted to ask you about before we transition into asking some questions from the listeners that I have here for you. And it's something to do with you. Part of why you signed up for your PhD was to avoid soiling yourself with the filth of commerce and the vulnerability of sales and business. And you wanted to live far, far away above the fray of the market world, aloof and safe in your clean ivory tower of pure gleaming ideas. And this is all, again, from your article. And you came down from that tower eventually and realized, like, okay, even in this space of being, realizing that we are all connected, we still have to get filthy and dirty if we want to exist in this world. So how does that idea, how do you live with these two sort of contrasting ideas?
Oh, sure. So this is kind of interesting. I'll back, let's see, I guess it was maybe like 7 years ago. I was not only in a PhD program, I was also really connected with a bunch of people who were really into sacred economics or gift economy. Mm-hmm. So this book by Charles Eisenstein called Sacred Economics, and it's a really good book. And another book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde, which is also a really good book. And it's basically all about how money is a form of debt, which there's also a book called Debt, The First 5,000 Years, that illuminates this point. And Nietzsche illuminated this point, which is that all currency that we have is a form of debt. And that it has this way of concentrating itself in the hands of the few. And basically it's bad news bears. Like it really is harmful. There's all sorts of ways that just the existence of money, as we know it, encourages, all sorts of objectification, all sorts of, treatment of the world as object.
And exploitation.
And yeah, exploitation, precisely. So I was like super hyper aware of this. And I started to think about, one day it just struck me, you know, I think I was writing an essay about how evil money is, that debt is a form of resentment. So like, literally, it's saying like, you owe me, like you took something from me and you owe me with interest.
Oh, I didn't just gift this to you.
No.
Right. You owe me. Okay. Keep going. I just wanted to.
I didn't just get this to you. You took it. You owe me. I was deprived of having it while you had it. So you owe me interest. And it's resentment. Like, and it's resentment that's backed up by violence. So,
and a lack mentality.
Yes, and a lack mentality, precisely, utterly precisely. So it was really interesting. One day I realized, you know, so I have all these judgments about debt and money and how evil they are. And I have all these resentments. I have so much resentment, just like endless volumes of resentment against the world. And I realized that as I judged money and our current economic system as evil, I was also judging myself as evil, wrong, bad for having these resentments. And it was basically like, I saw that if I didn't judge myself for having these resentments, if I really accepted it and really didn't hold that against me, it gave me more room to let those resentments go. And somehow in there, connected with that, and once again, I hope everybody listening will forgive me if this all sounds a bit abstract, but I just realized that, like, I'm not innocent either. Like, money isn't innocent, and I'm not innocent. And all of us who are adults, we're not innocent. And innocence, we don't have to be. Like,
what is innocence in this respect, just out of curiosity?
Like we've never done any harm.
Okay.
You know, and I think that was an ideal for me, like harmlessness was an ideal for me. And I just really realized that there's a certain way in which everything is harm. Everything, you know, life and destruction are completely entwined. Mm-hmm. So I certainly would like to see a new evolution of money happen. And I think it will, like with these cryptocurrencies and everything, they're not the same as debt-based currency. They're not monitored by a nation state and they're not backed up by violence. You know, the US dollar is backed up by the US military. That's why it's been so strong for so long. But there's another wave coming. And in the meantime, I just realized that it's okay for me to be part of the big mess because, hell, I'm already part of the big mess. And when I try to hold my nose and get, you know, abstain from it all, I'm doing that out of resentment. Like, I'm doing that out of being like, well, this is so fucked up and it shouldn't be fucked up and I'm going to go over here and take my toys and leave me alone, you know? Like, mm-hmm. There's a way in which that's a form of not being intimate and not being vulnerable. So, you know, when people talk about Tantra, they tend to be talking about sex and sexual energy, which is obviously very intense and high sensation. I really think that money, especially our current form of it and all of its less than innocent dimensions, has that too. It's like there's a tantric approach to money, just like there's a tantric approach to sex, which is really like, how present can we be here? And that's what it comes down to, like, how open to the full spectrum of sensation are we willing to be?
So I'm just curious about, because, you know, this is like really deep approval you'd have to give of yourself here. I mean, because this is something that's probably a lot of people's biggest resentment is, you know, being part of this system that's run on violence and exploitation and being stuck in it, part of it. I mean, I know people struggle with that because they email me and ask about that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So go ahead. Well, I was going to ask just for a little clarification on, you know, with that resentment you held, did you feel like you were owed something by all the society, all the money and society and violence and wrongdoings?
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, I probably wouldn't have consciously articulated it that way, but like, I definitely felt like some hand should just descend from the sky and give me everything that I want because I've been so wronged by being born into this debased society. So there's that.
Were there ideas of you thinking that you were also like pure too within that?
Oh yes. Oh yes. I mean, I was the pure put upon victim.
Okay.
And that was another part of the realization, was seeing that, like, I mean, basically, and I still give in to this temptation because it is just so delicious. Like, there's hardly anything more delicious in the world than feeling oneself to be victimized by something terrible. And I don't say that in an uncaring way. I hope people understand that I'm talking about the believing oneself to be wronged can be so poignant and pungent and really delightful. And I had that. And part of my growing out of that was realizing that I was not innocent, that whenever I held resentments, I caused harm. And there was just like no planet on which I was pure. Like, I was just a part of the, and not only that, not just me personally, but I guess I had some realization where I really felt vividly how whatever painful, ugly stuff goes on in the world, exploitation or capitalism, terror, all of its forms, I really saw that those were not things that were separate from me, that they all existed within me. And that I didn't need to try to be separate from them because it was impossible to be separate from them.
Dang, I'm like, let's all take mushrooms and figure this out.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I love that. And that's, I know people are like trying to wrap their minds around that right now.
Well, maybe I should, I don't know if I should tell you, I have a story for you now.
I love stories.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking maybe I should save it for our secret episode because it's a little, you know, it's a little risque.
Ooh, I love risque stories. And you know, this is all the kind of stuff I want to share for the listeners. This is all the kind of stuff that is like, this is in your shadow side. This is in those unconscious desires and resentments and all those things you carry around that when you start doing shadow work and tapping into them, they come to the surface. And that the reason shadow work can be so hard is because you get to see this stuff of like what you're made of so clearly sometimes that you're just shocked and horrified. And that the challenge is to still love yourself and accept yourself. And So the reason I love Carolyn Elliott, I'm just going to throw some love on you because I think you're an amazing teacher. And I think that you, all of your experience with your PhD and everything really did give you the skills to take these complex topics and put them into understandable formats that you turned into systems that people can use to actually like systematically and effectively and powerfully and also really fucking funly, if that's a word, do shadow work. And so that's, listeners, if you are like, wow, how can I do more of this? How can I get more deeply into this? Then I 1000% recommend Influence, which is Carolyn's course on practical magic, but it's really a course on shadow work. So it's worth every penny. I've taken it. I paid for it. I'm not getting paid to say this. If I could teach it better, I would, but I can't. So I'm not even going to try. Like Carolyn is the one to go to.
Oh, thank you so much, Natalie. That makes me so happy.
Awesome. So now that, you know, I think it's a great point to transition to some questions from the audience for a few minutes here. And I got a lot of questions, so I apologize to everyone who sent questions. Thank you for sending them. I'm just going to scroll through them here and just see what kind of pops out after and feels aligned with our conversation here. And so let's see. I think this is interesting because you did mention prayer at one point in our conversation, and this question asks about prayer. So you ready? Mm-hmm. All right. This question says, among a couple of other ways, prayer has become one of my favorite practices for manifestation and healing. Does Miss Elliott, have anything to say about the relationship between prayer, magic, and ritual? More importantly, does she have any recommendations on how one can stay safe and discerning when it comes to beings from the other realms? And I guess this person is asking about praying to beings in the other realms. I don't have any more information, so I'm just going to hand it over to you and see what you do.
Sure. Okay. I like this question. First, I don't see any difference between prayer, ritual, or magic. They're all the same bag of tricks to me. I do think, I guess you could say that prayer, usually as people do it, it's more like a form of talking to the divine. And what I learned from prayer in 12-step groups when I was in my early 20s, I think is still really makes the most sense to me, which is that you're basically tuning, when you are praying, you are tuning yourself onto sort of the radio dial of divinity. You're getting your own consciousness on that vibe so that you can, receive from it and learn from it. And so that is how I think of prayer. And so usually when I'm aiming to pray, I'm trying to get myself into a state of really deep humility and gratitude and expansive wonder, because those are qualities that I, in my experience, are connected to the divine. So there's that. When it comes to various entities, my general practice, I work with the planetary deities. So I work with, the sun, Jupiter, Venus, Mars, Mercury, Saturn. And those guys are very standard. They're very,
tried and true.
Tried and true, yes. And you kind of know what you're getting when you interact with them. There are other magicians I know who really like to engage with things like the Lesser Key of Solomon, also known as the Goetia, which is like a catalog of 72 spirits that are, they're the kings of hell and the dukes and the, they include like Lucifer and all sorts of spirits who are known to get things done, but might also fuck with you and do all sorts of things like that. And I just haven't felt the call to go there. I haven't felt the need. Like, I work with Jupiter for money stuff, and Jupiter does everything just fine and no funny business. So there's that. I also, when I pray, I sort of just address myself. I mean, unless I'm doing like a specific ritual with a specific planetary deity, I usually just address myself to the universe, to divinity, you know, quite general. There's a saying from one of my favorite occult writers, who's just a great guy all around. I love him, Lon Milo Duquette, who says, you know, in response to the question, isn't magic all in your head? He says, yes, and your head is a lot bigger than you think it is. So meaning, I love that. Meaning that, you know, everything that exists, exists within consciousness, and consciousness is subjective. So everything that we experience, including, you know, our studies of science or including our experiences of other people, is only happening in our subjective consciousness as far as we can ever, ever know. So I believe that entities, spiritual entities, are just as real as other people are real. And also, they're a part of me, just like all other people are a part of me. So,
just like capitalism and all those things that we talked about a few minutes ago are part of you.
A part of me, completely and inescapably a part of me. And it's impossible for me to ever be separate from them. So, so with that understanding, I would never endorse like a fearful attitude towards what's out there, because ultimately it's all us and there's really nothing you can encounter that is truly alien in the sense of like not you. So there's that, but at the same time it might, you know, could do all sorts of unpleasant things to the being that you currently believe yourself to be. So there's that.
Your identity might be threatened.
Completely destroyed. Yeah, really threatened. And in fact, you know, as you get closer to enlightenment, and magic is a practice that leads to enlightenment, ultimately, that's what happens, is some cataclysmic things can happen that can really shake up your identity. And that's sort of like part of the package. So number one, but it doesn't for all forms of magic, I should say. Like I'm thinking of specifically like forms of magic that are directed towards enlightenment. But in general, in magic has a way of like sneaking, you know, showing you things that you may not have been so keen to see.
Being honest with yourself.
Yes, precisely. I feel like I'm not perfectly answering the question. Like there's some little element here about, okay, dealing with deities. I mean, I'm not sure if this person, if like the person's talking about like they're having communications with entities via like Ouija boards or scrying or something like that. I mostly don't do that. I mostly, you know, I relate to local spirits and things like that, but mostly just through the forms of offerings or talking. One adventurous thing that I did recently as part of my Promethea project, which I'm doing in dialogue with Alan Moore's wonderful book, Promethea, is I started communicating just kind of conversationally and also through offerings with a goetic deity or goetic being named Asmodeus, who is one of the traditional kings of hell in the Solomonic Gospels, in the Key of Solomon. But my communication with him was not in the traditional Solomonic grimoire way, where you create like a triangle of conjuration and you like command them to be present and you're like ordering them around under the names of Jehovah and whatnot. So I just always thought that was rude. So it's been more like inspired by, I guess you could say, like the Tibetan feeding your demons practice, where you are basically offering yourself to a demon that you've identified within yourself. And Asmodeus is basically like, he's like the entity of disliking and being really critical and really hateful and mean. And like I said, I love seeing things as being wrong and bad and horrible. So me and Asmodeus are like buds. We're like on the same page there. So I have been experimenting with just like communicating with Asmodeus and really like just showering him with love whenever like I hear his sort of tone or presence arise in my consciousness.
So that makes me think of like in this non-dual awareness of, you know, if you're showering him with love, but he is residing in you, then you're really just showering that aspect of you with love intentionally in a way.
Precisely. Yes.
I mean, magic's so fun and amazing, but it's also like, so like you're standing in a bathroom with mirrors all around and it's just like those infinity mirrors.
Yeah. Or magic makes you aware of how you're always standing in those.
Right. Right. Yeah,
exactly. Yes, it is true. And that's why I like to say that magic is intimacy with reality, because whenever you are actively participating in synchronicity, it's always revealing to you more and more of those mirrors.
Mm-hmm. And actually that leads right into another question. I think this is the same person asked this. And does Carolyn know anything about mirror magic?
Oh.
That's a yes or no question, so you can say yes or no. I'm just kidding.
I know of it. I wonder if this person is talking about scrying, like having a black mirror where, like, I know that Enochian magic works where the magician or the scryer looks into a mirror at different Enochian levels. I have not done that. I guess there's also like folk mirror magic when you look into mirrors and cast spells on yourself. Mm-hmm. I do a little bit of that, which is that I consecrate my makeup to Venus, and I do different glamour spells with that for fun. And so when I'm putting on my makeup, I'm putting on that energy.
Put it on your Venus face?
Putting on my Venus face, yes. So, but that's a pretty, you know, minor level. So I'm not precisely certain, but I guess I'm not an experienced mirror magic practitioner.
Okay. didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, no, no.
So then here's one. Let's do one more question, and then we'll wrap it up, and we'll head to the secret episode. So mm-hmm. Here's this. This person says, I would love to hear you and Carolyn talk about what pop culture characters or archetypes you are inspired by. In a prior episode, Carolyn mentioned the Katy Perry song Dark Horse, and I was wondering if you all could talk more about other pop culture, movie, music references, and imagery that you find helpful to power up your magic.
Oh, okay. Cool. How about you go first, Natalie?
Oh, gosh. I didn't think about this at all. Let's see. What do I find helpful? I find, so in archetypes, I do find them through musicians, and anyone who knows me personally in my life will know I love PJ Harvey. And there's just like there's just something about her, the way she just embodies this tenderness and this like gruesomeness, and she just rocks so hard, but she's also so soft. Something about the way she embodies these different energies and the way that she expresses it through her music just turns me on so hard. I'm like, what? I'm like ready. If I hear PJ Harvey music, I'm just ready for whatever. I'm like, let's go. So if I know if I need to get powered up, I can just turn that on and I'll be like, all right, here we go. And does it power up my magic? Heck yeah, because it's like this representation, this manifestation of all of these kind of ingredients in my subconscious soup. And I feel like tapping into that just helps me tap into that aspect of me that is this kind of like, rawr, like this roaring jaguar.
Mm, beautiful.
Yeah. Your turn.
I would say probably my foremost magical inspiration in recent times is Daenerys Targaryen.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
I mean, you know, just breaker of chains, mother of dragons, you know, like that's what it's about.
And oh, yeah. She's so hot.
Yeah, so hot. So I often get inspired. Just the other weekend, I was on a retreat and we had a fire walk to do, like walking across hot coals. And of all the people there, I was least excited about it. And I was genuinely looking really hard for ways to get out of it. And the thought popped into my head, you know, I am the mother of dragons, the unburnt. I was like, I need to walk on these coals. Like,
right now.
Right now. And then I walked across them and it was awesome. So that was some pretty direct inspiration right there.
What would Daenerys do? WWDD.
Exactly. Exactly. In terms of music, wow. I really love Lana Del Rey. I love her. Her weird hermetic imagery.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Who else? You know, I've become like I used to be really hip, Natalie. I hope that somebody believes me that like I used to know all the cool new music and make mix CDs back when people still made mix CDs. And I really am not that hip anymore in terms of listening to music. I do know who. Ty, my husband and I have a shared musical inspiration. His name is, I'm going to have to actually Google because I can remember the name of the song right now, but not the name of the art. Oh, Jidenna. And the song is called Hail to the Chief. And all of his other songs. We love Jidenna. He just like hits the right Capricorn Scorpio vibe that makes us so happy. So that guy.
I'll check that out. See, I'm not hip either, and I was like never hip, so I might have been hip at one point. I don't know.
Yeah, for a hot minute, long ago, once upon a time, I really think I attained it, and then it just like ran through my fingers like water, and then I woke up one morning and found myself listening to Enya, and it's been all over since.
I'm a Deep Forest fan, personally.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out, though. Jidenna, cool. So is there anything that's like archetypal about Jidenna that really gets you going?
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about like, okay, so Jidenna is a man of part African American, part European American heritage. I think I'm getting that right. So he's like biracial. And he talks about that and he really embodies this, I would say, this like tantric attitude towards race and like inhabiting all of the different forms of it. On a more controversial note, I would also say that an inspiration of mine is D'Antoard, who also embodies that kind of tantric attitude towards race in a way that could be offensive, but I think is pretty brilliant. Which is just like getting into, well, I just don't have an easy way to describe it. If anybody's not familiar with D'Antoard, I would suggest checking them out.
Can you spell it?
What's that?
Can you spell that for us?
Oh, yes. So D'Antoard is South African for the answer. So it's D-I-E-D and then Antoward, A-N-T-W-O-R-D. And the song Fatty Boom Boom is the most intense D'Antoard place to start, would say.
I can link to all those in the show notes too.
Mm-hmm. So from there, and I'm sure I love pop culture. I'm sure I have other pop culture inspirations, but I think Natalie, you know, you've gotten me on to the like deeper.
I I know. We've went to a different direction in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's good. I think you sufficiently answered the question.
Okay.
I think you, this is like your defense, and I think you passed that one.
Okay, cool.
Do you remember your defense?
I do. It was pretty fun. It was the first time I wore like a real dress that wasn't like a $10 dress from H&M that was like an actual lady dress. So I remember it.
Very cool. Okay, so I think that will wrap it up and we'll head to the secret episode. There's some other really fun questions here, but maybe they'll have to wait for another day for the next time you come on the show. And so I'm curious. I know that you have influences coming out soon and you also offer Thrill. So you've got these two amazing courses. I've taken both. I can totally vouch for them. They're awesome. And if you take them and you do the work, you will get your shit together. In terms of like, if you want to make a business and get communicate with your audience, Thrill is your game. If you want to do some shadow work and really dive into that, influence is your game. Both of them are really your game for that. But so influence is going to open up soon and Thrill will be opening up in the future sometime again. And can you sign up for, do you have to be on your mailing list to be able to sign up for these courses?
You pretty much do.
Okay. So how can people do that?
Sure. They can just go to my website, my magazine, which is Witch Magazine, and the address is badwitch.es, and just put in your email address, and you will get notified when the courses open, and you will hear all about them, and you will hopefully come join us.
Oh, yeah, totally. It's worth it. And so, yeah, also for people who are curious, Carolyn runs the Witch Magazine at badwitch.es, and you can go there to read all of your, get all your witch article fixes.
Yes.
And is there any other thing you want to share or other ways people can reach you?
Oh, I think that's good. That'll right. do it.
They can send you a raven to
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm proud of us. We didn't give away any Game of Thrones spoilers, so we did really good here. Okay, then. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show again. And it's always such a pleasure to talk with you. So I'm super grateful that you were willing to come back on here and let me drill you with questions again.
Oh, thank you, Natalie. So much fun.
Thank you all so much for listening. And if you would like the secret episode, go to dreamfreedombeauty.com/secret and you can check it out. And make sure you go check out Influence, sign up for the newsletter over at badwitch.es and get on that newsletter so you can get all the details and information about Carolyn's offerings. And again, I want to say a huge thank you to our Patreon supporters and to everyone who has left a review on iTunes. You guys and gals are amazing. And one last thing, I'm putting together the pilot episode for the Self-Care Club and I'll be sharing that soon. So stay tuned to this new offering and adventure. It's been so exciting to put this together and I just really cannot wait to bring it out into the world to share with you all. So thank you so much. If you are interested in advertising on the Self-Care Club, then send me an email. Just go to dreamfreedombeauty.com and get in touch through the contact page and let me know you're interested and I will hook you up with the details and that would be awesome. All right. Y'all have an awesome week and I'll see you soon.